Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City Council meeting, City of Arroyo Grande, for Tuesday, March 9th. Roll call, please.
Council Board Member Reynolds.
Here.
Council Board Member Dickens.
Here.
Council Board Member Costello.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Vice Chair Lubin.
Here.
And Mayor Chair Ferrara.
Here as well. The council just adjourned from closed session. We have no report at this time. My apologies for starting the meeting late. It ran a little bit longer than we anticipated. Our flag salute this evening will be led by the Sue Ro Lee Sta Campfire. Did I get that right? Okay. Good. Thank you. We have affirmation here in front. After the flag salute, if you would remain standing for our invocation, Pastor Robert Banker is here from the Open Door Church of Oceano to lead us in the invocation. Ladies, are you all set?
Yeah.
Okay.
Shall we pray? Father, we lift up our hearts and voices of thanksgiving tonight for all the many good things that we enjoy and for all that the benefits that we receive. We do give thanks for the council and for their time spent and for their dedication, and we ask your blessing upon them. We just pray, dear Lord, that you would give them wisdom and guidance. This we ask in your name. Amen.
Okay, before we go on to special presentations, we usually allow the parties that come in and lead us in the flag salute to get up and tell us a little bit about the organization that they represent. So, Campfire, ladies, would you like to come up and talk a little bit about what your club is doing?
We'd like to. To increase awareness is absolutely incredible. I am Jeff, and I would like to present you with this Campfire Committee as a token of our appreciation for declaring March 18th absolutely incredible. I'm Joanna, and I would like to encourage every adult to write a letter of love, support, and appreciation to a child on March 18th. Thank you from the Sue Ro Lee Sta Club of Campfire Gifts.
Great. Are those for us? Do we have to share with everybody? You know, now that they've told you about absolutely incredible Kid Day, I guess I better finish with the proclamation itself. And that was part of agenda item 5 this evening, special presentations. So this is one of my favorite ones to give out every year. So ladies, I know that you've just sat down. So who's gonna take this proclamation? Okay, whoever's going to take it, why don't you come on back up here, and I'm going to read just a little bit of it. This is an honorary proclamation recognizing absolutely incredible Kid Day, March 18th, 2004. Whereas March 18th, 2004 has been declared by Campfire USA, a national youth development organization, as absolutely incredible Kid Day. And whereas Campfire USA commemorates its 8th annual Absolutely Incredible Kid Day, and whereas adults are encouraged to send letters of love and appreciation to young people in their lives as part of the celebration of children on this day, and whereas Campfire Council of the Central Coast serves over 3,000 children, teaching boys and girls self-reliance, good citizenship, and leadership, and whereas Campfire USA mission pledges a firm commitment to building caring, confident youth and future leaders, an extension of that commitment is handed to caring adults through this event to express their feelings in a letter or a note, which has the profound ability to make a lasting and positive impact on the children in our country. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Tony Ferrara, Mayor of the City of Arroyo Grande, on behalf of the City Council, do hereby proclaim March 18th, 2004, as Absolutely Incredible Kid Day in the city of Aurora Grande, and we urge all adults to participate by sending letters to express their feelings and appreciation to young people in their lives. So it's my pleasure to present this to you. Thank you very much. We have one more presentation this evening, and I would like to ask Ben Hall of the American Red Cross to come forward. Good evening. Right there is fine, because I'm going to shift this microphone in just a second. This is an honorary proclamation recognizing March 2004 as American Red Cross Month. Whereas the American Red Cross is a humanitarian organization led by volunteers with a mission to provide relief to victims of disaster and to help people prepare for citizens of Aurora Grande to become partners in preparedness with their local Red Cross chapter and to become active participants in advancing the noble mission of the Red Cross. And it's my pleasure to present this to you, Ben, and if you'd like to say a word about the local chapter, we'd sure appreciate it.
Thank you much.
Okay.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Council members. Just be a few moments. One thing I know, it seems like every time I get to do one of these, I get to follow some kids. It's a tough act to follow. It truly is. This is my final and sixth year on the board, the Red Cross, local Red Cross board. Also, I'm kind of speaking because I'm a over 30-year resident of Aurora Grande, and I'm proud to say that, too. It's a great city. Thank you for this. I can tell you just a couple little insights from my part is that, you know, Red Cross gets a lot of publicity when we have the big emergencies, the big disasters, those type of things. What doesn't get seen is usually the daily disasters, personal disasters that the Red Cross volunteers respond to. I was watching the kids here and a few several years ago just down the street from my house in Aurora Grande. Woke up in the morning, fire trucks were down the street, packed a couple of my youngsters off about that age so they could watch the scene, you know, with a hot sandwich, and went down there later to gather them up, and they're there, and so was the Red Cross volunteer at 5 o'clock in the morning. So I'm just here to say thank you for that proclamation. I'm part of the staff, across the hundreds of volunteers that are part of this San Luis Obispo Red Cross chapter. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, that takes us to item number 6, agenda review. Move that all resolutions and ordinances presented tonight be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. That takes us to item number 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for any member of the community to come forward and comment on items not on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act prohibits the council from taking any action on items not on this evening's agenda. But we might take your comment or your observation and refer you to a member of staff or perhaps set up some form of a meeting with you at a later date. We'd like your comments to be limited to 3 minutes or less, and please address the council as a whole. Any member of the audience would like to come forward at this time? Okay, seeing none, we will close community comments. That will take us to item number 8, which is our consent agenda. This is often a group of items that we approve in one motion, and that we've all had an opportunity, the members of the council have had an opportunity to look over these items in great detail. And is there any member of the council that would like to pull a particular item or comment on an item for further review?
Mr. Mayor, I would need to pull item 8D. I have a conflict of interest due to the proximity of my personal residence.
Okay. Item 8D. Any other items?
Mr. Mayor, I would like to pull 8G just for a question, please.
Okay.
Changes and whatnot. But my question is, since that is on the outside of the Las Bears Creek Channel, I would assume that we're going to inherit that portion of the Las Bears Creek Channel. And considering that is supposedly going to be taken over by the state, what parameters are we going to be forced to work with or without as far as keeping the creek clean and whatnot, or does anybody have the answer to that? This is a last-minute question that came in.
You're correct in the inclusion of a segment of the Los Barrios Channel east of Valley Road over to the boundary of the church. So we would take in a segment of both Los Barrios Road and the Los Barrios Channel. There is no public responsibility, city responsibility, in terms of the maintenance of that channel. There's certainly potential concern if the state or the county fail to maintain it adequately, but there is no provision in the annexation one way or another that would make the city responsible.
Okay, thank you.
Any other discussion on 8G? Hearing none, do we have a motion to approve?
So moved. Adoption of 8G.
Okay. Second. We have a motion and a second. Any other discussion? Roll call, please.
Councilmember Reynolds?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Lubin?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. That will take us to consent item 8D. Mayor Pro Tem Lubin is standing down. Do we have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion on 8D? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Reynolds?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. That takes us to item 9, our public hearings. We have one this evening, 9A, consideration of appeal of Planning Commission denial of condition number 43, tract number 2275. Good evening, Rob.
Mayor, members of the council, this item is an appeal of a Planning Commission unanimous decision. The Planning Commission received a request in late December to consider waiver of the public utility undergrounding requirement on the previous tentative tract map approval. The location of the project is depicted in green on the screen, basically behind Oro Drive and Plata Road, adjacent to the Wildwood Ranch planned development. The map now on the screen is a larger a copy of that subdivision map circled to the western edge of the six-lot tract are two poles that were indicated on the tentative tract map as to be removed. In the initial request to the Planning Commission, it was suggested that...
Application on the rationale, why maybe the applicant can answer this evening, but why is the rationale for this request? That was unclear to me within the staff report. Do you have any idea why this request came before us?
The basic explanation when we, Public Works and Community Development, met with the applicant on the property was a matter of cost. The pole that he requests remain happens to be the service drop to the underground of Wildwood Ranch, and for him to underground it would require that he basically pay the cost of removal of that pole and extending of the underground service from the lower pole, which is on the approach drive to the subdivision from Wasna Road. It's strictly an economic issue. The rationale that we put in the staff report is that the hill is prominent. The poles are the only poles that are within the subdivision boundaries, and that there is a consistent policy of requiring undergrounding with new development. So we recommended denial to the commission. The commission unanimously agreed.
Okay, thank you.
Any other
comments? Yes, under the original agreement, the developer did sign off on the fact that he was going to remove those two poles.
Yes, this was a initial condition of the tentative tract map, and that's some years ago. And it was only in the latter stages of the tract improvements that this request was received.
Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem.
One question, Rob. What's the distance from that pole drop to Wozniak Road that would have to be underground?
There's a intermediate series of poles on the lower approach driveway that are outside the boundaries of the subdivision. The road, if I can... There is a pole in this vicinity that feeds up to the pole at this location, and then there is an extension from this service drop pole into the Wildwood Ranch underground with overhead lines to an additional pole that feeds both the primary residence and the secondary dwelling on the site. The applicant has agreed that this pole would be removed and is requesting that this pole remain. So it is this segment of underground, all within the tract. This pole is just beyond the boundaries of the required undergrounding, and then there are additional poles that extend down to Wozniak Road, I believe three poles.
So he would not be required to underground to Wozniak Road?
That's just correct. Just only the upper two poles within the tract boundaries, nothing along the approach drive.
Thank you.
Any other questions, clarifications on the staff report? Okay, this is a public hearing, and we generally allow the either applicant or, in this case, the appellant first opportunity. So if you would please come to the podium and state your name for the record.
One pole down. Now, I know this has nothing to do with it, but given Wildwood permission to cross my property, but I have to spend a lot of money. I've dealt with PG&E, and they said, I said, why is it going to cost this much? He said, because we have to do a lot of work to rectify Wildwood, and... He said, this way it is. Now, I've got the first pole. PG&E said they could take it down for about $5,000. And I know that has nothing to do with, people don't have, the cost. They don't want to hear this. But it's to remove Wildwood's pole, it's going to cost about $25,000. And... if I'd have won the lottery, I wouldn't have mind. And then I don't know how it got on tentative map that those poles would be removed. I think it was my engineers. I had two engineers on the job up there, Fard one, and he gave all this stuff to the other engineer, and the other engineer was supposed to have been here tonight. I don't see him. But I would just hope you could take in consideration of that one pole. And you can see the pictures there. Those pictures were taken off of Nikolai Alexander's deck. And so he was supposed to have been here, but he teaches a Russian class, and he couldn't make it. So I don't know much more to tell you that... I know costs don't mean nothing to most people, but an old country boy, it gets tough sometimes. So I wish they had a lot more to say. I'll probably think about it after I sit down. Can I come back if it need be?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Good. That's usually the way it works. You make your best speeches in the parking lot after you're all done in here.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Dodson. Any other member of the public that would like to come forward and comment on item 9A? This would be an opportunity to do so.
Mr. Mayor, Council, my name is George Roach. You have in your package the speaker slip that we prepared from Wildwood Ranch to present our points. We believe that with this kind of a development going in there and the size and beauty of the area, the lots that are going to be, the homes that will be built there, will also be appreciative of undergrounding of the other pole. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Good evening. I'm Don Parker. I live at 819 Plata Drive, right below the subdivision. And if there's a technical reason why these things need to be undergrounded.
My name is Ron Olson. I live at 514 Platino Lane, which is the other side of the property, not the Plata side that Mr. Parker lives in, but the other side. I don't see it from my home, and that's not my issue. But my thinking is, and I realize that Mr. Dotson probably unknowingly agreed to this, or maybe had no choice at the time that the tentative map conditions were placed. It seems to me that if he's willing to move the pole that provides power to his property, that I guess I have a hard time understanding why when he was, I don't believe he had any choice probably, but to have the pole put on his property when the Wildwood subdivision was put in and the power was run underground from that lower pole to feed Wildwood, but and perhaps that's the time it should have been put underground when Wildwood was putting their development in. There's not quite a large number of homes there too. I've lived in the neighborhood for 30 years, so I've seen it all change. But anyway, I just think fair is fair. I don't understand why Mr. Dotson's being put to the expense of relocating a pole that he probably had no choice that it be put on the property, and it benefits everyone else, not him. So, thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, last chance. We'll close public comment on 9A. And let's see, Councilmember Costello, why don't you start this one off, if you don't mind?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I've struggled with this issue in terms of undergrounding poles for years. Back in the years when I was on the Planning Commission, we would frequently have applicants come before us with projects. And the city's position is we're going to have as many poles removed as possible because of the visual impact they do. In this case, we're getting comments from property owners that want the poles removed because of the visual impact they have, and comments from other property owners that there's no impact on them from the poles almost directly in their own backyards. Mr. Dotson or his agents agreed to remove the poles originally, and at this point he's come back to us and asked that one of them be removed and the second not be removed because of cost factors. And at this point, it seems like we have a clear-cut position in our general plan that we're going to remove the power poles when we have this kind of work done. So I'm inclined to stand by the original ruling to have both the poles removed. Unless I can be convinced otherwise, that's the position I'll be taking.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Mr. Mayor, I think that in regards to this particular issue, it's important for the public to realize that in regards to the fairness issue that we have probably, I don't know when the exact fairness, and yet I think I stand by the policy that the city is trying to maintain in regards to alleviate the negative impacts that overhead utilities do have. It could be argued, yes, that this particular location has a very minimal impact, although we see that from some residents it does and from some residents it doesn't. We also are not taking into account the future residents that this particular project will then be bringing in, and they'll be at least four or five additional folks living up on that hillside that may be impacted from that particular pole. One looks like it probably would be close to their front yard. So those folks don't have the ability to speak here because they haven't moved in yet. In regards to the issue of the policy, I stand behind the policy. I think at this point it's important to go the extra mile. And within this case, if we were to leave that pole, it would be the only existing pole within that particular area. So I would certainly support and uphold the Planning Commission's decision to deny this particular request. So that's all I have to say, Mr. Mayor. Thank you.
Councilmember Reynolds.
I have a question, probably of either Rob or the applicant. This pole that I'm looking at, this picture here, that services the house that's on presently the house that Mr. Dodson owns at the top of the hill. Is that not correct? Okay. Now, the pole that Wildwood, is this the drop that Wildwood gets all of their power off of?
Yeah.
For the whole development?
The whole development.
Okay. Now, that pole being on your property or on that property, did you own the property at the time that development was put in there? And you gave PG&E permission to put that in? So, in other words, you knew the pole was going to be there, and you didn't ever anticipate having to take it down. Well, I think that, and I would take it that the undergrounding wasn't on the books at the time that Wildwood put that development in, Rob. Is that not correct?
Wildwood is also undergrounded. The pole that they obtained service from was more than the 6 foot from the subdivision boundary, and they were not required to remove that pole. The same way Mr. Dodson is not required to remove the poles on his approach drive behind the residences that lead in from Wasna Road. So it's within the track boundary that the undergrounding is required and was proposed. And the original approval was in May of 2001, and the appeal was filed in December 2003.
This is kind of reminiscent of a situation we had up on James Way where there was a pole that was about 6 feet, 6 inches outside the boundary, and it was discussed about that. Well, you know, I don't like to make a man move a pole that's somebody else is getting the benefit from, but I would agree with my colleagues that this is a visual thing, and it's probably going to be better to get rid of it, so I'll uphold the appeal. I'll uphold the Planning Commission's decision.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Politically correct picture there. Okay. I wanted to go back to another question that was asked earlier. I want to make sure I'm understanding it properly. Do we know that a pole was specifically added to the Dodson property for Wildwood?
I do not know that to be the fact. Whether the pole was there or whether it was installed in order to enable a service drop to Wildwood, perhaps Mr. Dodson knows the answer.
Well, I heard Mr. Dodson say that, and I tend to believe him. I just wanted to confirm that with you, but you don't know for sure on your side. Okay. So what we're saying is that the Wildwood development, which undergrounded, was only able to underground because of a pole that was added to Mr. Dodson's property some years ago. Approximately how many years ago was that?
About 20 years.
Mr. Dodson, could I ask a favor? Since we're likely to get a couple of questions that only you can answer, would you mind coming back to the mic for just a few minutes until we're done here? Thank you.
So I guess where I'm making sure I have my points correct, approximately 20 years ago, Wildwood was developed, and during that development, in order to underground the utilities, which is what we want, which our code requires, we added a pole to the Dodson property. That would be a correct assumption, Rob?
That's what Mr. Dodson has explained, and that is not unusual to have a pole installed in the vicinity of a subdivision.
Okay. Mr. Dodson, at that time, did you pay to have the pole installed for Wildwood?
No. Wildwood, or PG&E did it for Wildwood. Now, I don't know what if it cost them anything or not.
Okay.
But that's a big line that goes to feed Wildwood right there.
Where does it come from? Does it come from this other pole?
It comes off from Wasna.
Comes directly off of Wasna.
And when they did Wildwood, PG&E had that set up to come from the other side. Oh, well, we're on 227. But it was going to cost so much for the project to bring it from that side. Well, the guy doing it come up with the idea, and I said, well, it's not going to bother me.
Okay.
So you got you one thing, a guy's just going to have to not do any favors for anyone.
Yeah.
And that's a shame. It's like city of Rio Grande, back about a year and a half ago, called me in Tennessee, the engineering department. They said, Mr. Dodson, we're going to pave Wasna Road, but there are storm drains that you're going to have to put in. Could you do that in the next 8 or 10 days? Well, I said, I don't know, but I'll get on the phone and find out. So I called Beecham Construction. Well, he said, I can't do it that quick. I said, well, the city, I mean, they pine tree blocks that down through there. And there's other poles down through there. Now, this five lots that the planning department was so nice to give me on 8.5 acres, that's all underground.
Right. Okay, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. That's all the questions I had. Thank you, Mr. Dodson.
So you want me to sit down?
For a minute.
Well, before you leave, and I know you haven't finished yet, but so you don't have to come back up, let me ask
I don't mind.
One last question. I'm confused by a point that the Mayor Pro Tem brought up. Earlier you said that it was going to cost $5,000 to remove one pole. And $25,000 for the other pole.
Yeah. And that's, but
so $30,000 for both poles.
It's going to cost $35,000 for both poles.
Okay.
I'm confused. But the biggest cost is on moving Wildwood's pole that feeds Wildwood. That's the one that costs so much money.
Okay. Why is that going to cost that much money?
I don't know. PG&E didn't break it down.
Okay. Thank you.
You want me to sit down now, right?
Thank you. I have to tell you, I came with every intention tonight to uphold the Planning Commission because we do have our ordinances and we have our regulations, and having read the staff report, there was a commitment made in 2001 to remove both poles. However, I'm having problems with the $25,000, assuming that's even a close bid for that main pole. And I'm even having more problems with the fact that the pole was put in to benefit Wildwood on Mr. Dodson's property. And then we come back 20 years later and say, okay, we want you to take that pole out. And he's going to have to come up with $25,000, give or take a little, to do that. So at this point, I can't justify in my mind having someone take out a pole that he was nice enough to put in the first place. So, Rob, you have your finger up, so I'm assuming you want to talk.
Only to attempt to explain why that second pole might have been installed by PG&E. The picture illustrates that there is a transformer on the pole that is closest to the house. And my understanding is PG&E will not place a service drop off of a pole that has a transformer on it because of the necessity of climbing the pole to service the transformer. So presumably there was an existing pole to service the house. If they could have put the service drop off of that pole, if there had not been the transformer, they wouldn't have installed another pole, but it still would have been a subsequent cost of subdivision to remove that.
I still have a problem with that. And so from a financial standpoint, if both these poles cost $5,000 and it was just one was pretty and one wasn't, I'd say take them both out. But here we have a significant difference in dollars, and I have trouble justifying that in my mind. So I would vote to support the appeal at this point, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. I guess, I would agree in part with some of the comments that the Mayor Pro Tem made. But I think we have to take a look at the existing policy, and if I understand it correctly, this is attendant to a six-unit development proposal. And the way the policy reads, correct me if I'm wrong, Rob, and I know you will, if the development were not to occur, then the pole would remain there indefinitely. The way the policy reads is that if there is going to be subsequent development, then the undergrounding requirement comes into play. So that's, I think, the piece that's been underemphasized in this whole discussion. I can empathize. It seems like an exorbitant cost, and I'm not sure if we have any latitude or any influence at all with PG&E on these matters, but I would certainly support some form of a letter or something that we could send on behalf of Mr. Dotson to PG&E to see if we couldn't come up with a better figure than whatever it is, $30,000 or $35,000, for the removal of that pole. The bottom line is we have the policy in place, and in my mind, that means we either have the policy or we don't. We either enforce it or we don't. If the policy is unfair or the policy is something that we shouldn't have on the books, then we need to change it. But if it's still there and the general consensus is that, since this has been reviewed just recently, the general consensus is that it should remain, then we need to abide by it. So I would agree with my colleagues that I would support the position that the Planning Commission reached in denying the applicant's request for modification of the condition. So those are my comments. Once again, I would see if there would be something we could do to see if perhaps we couldn't get some easing of the pain on the cost of the removal of those poles. I don't know what kind of track record we've had with PG&E, but I would think a letter couldn't hurt.
I have another question, Mr. Mayor, for me, please. Rob, on this photograph that I'm looking at here where that tree, the pole is behind that tree, is that where the drop is coming off for Wildwood?
Up
but the drop is going to be moved from this pole to a different pole, correct?
Correct. It still has to drop from the overhead service that is on the approach road from Wasner Road. So there's two or three poles where that service is still overhead. Outside of Mr. Dodson's subdivision, it's only within Mr. Dodson's subdivision that this one pole provides the service drop. It would occur on the lower pole.
That doesn't make any sense to me to make somebody move something that's already working and then have to spend a lot of money just to replace it. Then.
Right. There's an underground conduit from this pole to the distribution system serving Wildwood. Instead, there would be an underground conduit down to this pole, and there would be a service drop on this pole.
And then that would also extend all the way to the top of the hill.
That underground would feed the entire five-lot subdivision, including removal of the existing pole serving the house and secondary dwelling.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
What, excuse me. That new location for the drop that you pointed to down at the bottom, when would that be removed? When would that pole be removed?
Probably never, because it's in an existing subdivided area along the rear lines. So unless and until that neighborhood formed an underground utility district, that pole would not be removed.
So what we're gaining is the removal of the two poles at the top, but not the removal of the poles in this whole area.
Correct. There are additional poles. In addition to this one, there's some more on the way down to Wasner Road. And those are all in existing subdivided area that would not be undergrounded.
Any other questions?
I'd like to ask. If we've got multiple poles in this neighborhood, how many poles do we have throughout the community that are never going to be removed, not just in this neighborhood, but elsewhere?
I don't think there's ever been a count. There's certainly been a priority of effort given to existing commercial areas, the village, the trafficway vicinity, Grand Avenue, for systematic undergrounding of existing overhead utilities. Many of the pre-1970s subdivision have overhead utilities, and most of those utilities will remain in place. It's only when there's a undeveloped, relatively large parcel within that subdivided area that this policy applies, and then at some times during subdivision approval, applicants request a waiver of utilities, and the Planning Commission sometimes grants them and sometimes not. And if the applicant disagrees at the time of tentative subdivision map approval, the condition could have been appealed and it could have been an issue. It was not taken as an issue until the subdivision time extension had been granted and the bulk of the improvements in place, and it was only at this final stage of construction that the applicant requested modification of the condition.
I think it almost comes back to the question removed. I'd suggest that maybe we want to rethink the policy, but if the policy stands and it's in place, I have to support it.
We are proposing some changes to policy, primarily as they relate, and it was at the direction, I think, Council and Planning Commission members both had discussed it in a meeting a couple months ago, of preparing what we're referring to as an underground utility fee, underground utility in lieu fee, which for certain circumstances when there's poles involved in areas where the poles may be in a middle of an area where none of the other poles are going to be undergrounded, or if there's some special circumstances that requires an unusual burden on a property owner, that they might be recommended. We think those fees will address a lot of the type of issues that come up. We don't believe that fee really relates to this incident where we have a significant development and it was agreed to underground all those poles. There's one pole remaining. So I don't think this would be the type of situation that we would recommend that type of fee, but I think the fee will be able to address a lot of the circumstances in the past that you've referred to that have come up as problems.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
Okay. Go ahead.
One more question. What is the distance between the existing pole where the drop comes off and where it's going to be moved to?
It's difficult for me to read any dimensions on the map, but based upon the graphic scale and the approximate distance of Plata road width, I would estimate that there's probably 200 to 250 feet of undergrounding of overhead utility lines. 300
feet. Okay, and that road that we're talking about has just been recently paved and redone within the last 6 months?
yes.
If I recall correctly.
Right. That's part of the subdivision improvements.
That's part of the improvements.
Right.
So in other words, if we do this, you're going to go dig a trench down the middle of the road or along the side of the road and start over again as far as the road's concerned.
It would not necessarily have to be under the road. It could be to the side of the road. That's really a part of the design that Mr. Dodson and PG&E would have to resolve.
Okay, thank you.
Rob, you said something a moment ago that kind of caught my attention, and that is you made a comment about the Planning Commission and this particular policy. To your knowledge, have there been exceptions to this this policy in which on previous occasions under certain circumstances, or let me rephrase that, similar circumstances, there have been exceptions made?
On a case-by-case basis, when an applicant requests a waiver of underground utilities, the Planning Commission has on occasion found circumstances and waived the undergrounding requirement. There have been circumstances where the commission refused to make a waiver, and I believe those have been appealed to the council. I don't know the outcome of how many cases of that nature have existed that have had utility lines traversing side and rear where the commission has waived either in part or in full undergrounding. Where those poles existed, there were often residences being served from multiple poles that would be outside the subdivision, so it would have required the developer to coordinate with many of the surrounding residential uses to achieve undergrounding. And in those instances, the Planning Commission felt that it was inequitable, particularly with side and rear line utilities, to require full undergrounding. They've consistently required all new services be undergrounded within the subdivision. I don't know of any place where existing poles within the boundaries of the tract have been waived, such as these poles. These are within the boundaries.
I think the only case that I can recall, and I believe it came to us on an appeal, was in the neighborhoods south of Grand Avenue in some of the dense neighborhoods, where I think the case that I recall was a development proposal for multiple units on one small lot or one narrow, deep lot. And I think we were talking about somewhere around two or three units on one lot. And, of course, we had bird's nests of telephone or power poles all around there. And we were talking about multiple poles that were involved at a tremendous cost.
Right. One relatively recent case that went through both the Planning Commission and the City Council was the senior housing proposal at the Pike and Elm, involving existing poles along the west boundary of the tract that were actually on the adjacent residential lots serving the adjacent single-family homes. And in that instance, the developer requested and the commission approved the waiver of undergrounding that particular line, requiring that all the services within the tract would be undergrounded, but leaving existing poles in place. So it is not a precedent that there can be and have been utility undergrounding waivers. I think the Planning Commission, as well as the Council, has requested in those instances that there be consideration towards the contribution of funding to priority undergrounding locations, so that some portions of the existing utilities along arterial and collector streets within neighborhoods might be achieved, even if the rear line and sideline utilities through the neighborhoods aren't. And that's part of the reason that the policy is being pursued. But each case that has been considered by the Planning Commission is generally considered at the stage of the tentative map, not at the stage of the final map.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions, observations? Okay, we've already closed the public comment period. Okay, why don't you come on up? We'll make an exception here if you could.
And that's when this item was added to the punch list as a overlooked requirement. And subsequent to that, it was requested that it be modified, and that request of modifying it to just take out the one pole was proposed by the applicant. So the history has been that there was a tentative map approved, and subsequent to that, there was no action to do the work. And we wanted to follow up on that.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, if there's no other discussion or comments or questions, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I would move that the City Council approve a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande denying the appeal and upholding the action of the Planning Commission to require certain overhead utilities be placed underground for track map 2275 located at 801 Wasner Road, applied by James Dotson, with an added note to request that staff communicate with PG&E in determining the total cost of removing those poles and requesting any waiver in that cost to the applicant.
Okay, we have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second that, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call, please.
Councilmember Diggins?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Runnels?
No.
Mayor Pro Tem Lubin?
No.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, thank you. That takes us to item 10A, consideration of status report on Cortland Arroyo Grande LP Senior Affordable Housing Project.
Thank you.
Is that you, Steve? This is an information item.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. At the February 24th meeting, Mayor Pro Tem Lubin requested a status report on the Cortland Grand Senior Affordable Housing Project. As you will probably recall, at the December 9th, 2003 meeting, the Redevelopment Agency Board of Directors approved a revised DDA for the project in conjunction with an application from the developer for a 4% state tax credit application. Later that month, the tax credits were approved and accepted by the developer. They are now marketing the tax credits and developing documentation for issuance of the tax-exempt bonds. The deadline for issuance of the bonds is April 5th, so we should know within the next month whether there are any remaining problems that could potentially prevent the project from proceeding at this time. The agency's consultants are reviewing the bond documentation, and we've entered into and received from the proposed reduction in development impact fees for affordable housing units that was included in the housing element update. We expect that DDA amendment to be presented to the agency at the next council meeting. And at that time, we will probably have Tim Morenin, the agency's a housing consultant present there, and he can probably at that time provide more details to you in terms of some of the specific financial issues that are still being resolved. In speaking with the developer, his current plans are to begin grading in the summer and begin construction in the fall. So that concludes my report, but as I mentioned, with this item, parts of this item will come up again at the next meeting, and so we'll have an additional opportunity to discuss it. And please let me know if there's other information that either questions you have now or other information you'd like me to prepare for the presentation at that meeting.
Okay. Anybody have any questions? Mayor Pro Tem, this was your item. You have anything you want to comment on?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor. One of the points that I really want to make and be consistent with, and the reason I brought this up, was that the council originally approved this item on March 20th, 2002, and agreed to, through a number of vehicles, a substantial amount of money to the applicant. And my concern has always been that we are hanging out for a period of time the dollars that are sitting in the in-lieu fund fee or in-lieu fund that could be used for other projects if they were presented. I'm not saying any have been, but my concern has been that we're tying up these dollars without seeing that the project is completed. I believe at the December meeting, we talked about financial concerns, that there were some problems getting some of the loan commitments required for this project to move ahead. And so I still have a feeling that we're on a 50-50 basis with this project. I'm more than happy that I see that April 5th is going to be somewhat of a completion date for us, which will be a little over a year since we initially approved the project. I am still in support of this project. I would love to see this project go through. However, I do have concerns with that. And the information we receive at the next meeting is still not going to finalize whether this project is moving forward or not. We really won't know that until after April 5th. Am I correct in that, Steve?
That's correct.
Thank you. And so what I'd like to do is to be kept, the council to be kept apprised of this so that potentially the first meeting in April we're apprised that everything is fine, the bonds are issued, they're sold, and what the status is of the financial commitments by the developer. So we know that, yes, indeed, he will be grading in the
project. Have done the very best that they can do to bring to fruition a senior affordable housing project that the city needs. And I recognize also that while there have been delays, it has been largely due to factors beyond anyone's control. Changing policies at the state level, we all know what that can do to us and has done to us, and a number of our projects have been affected adversely as a result of it. So I don't have an issue with some of the delays. I understand why they're occurring, and I believe staff has done a fairly good job of keeping us informed on this. It's, again, a very, very complex financial package that folks are trying to put together to move this thing forward. So again, I would agree. I'm glad that we're taking another step forward in April and continue to move it along as fast as we can. Okay, that will take us to item number 11, new business. This is consideration of a pre-application review, case number 04-003. Kelly, good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, council members. Let me get myself situated here, if you don't mind. As you can see, the project site is located at the eastern entrance to the village at the corner of East Branch Street and Crown Terrace. And the project site is about 2.5 acres in size. And as you may recall, the Creekside Center project first emerged in the year 2000 as a pre-application, followed by formal applications to remove existing structures and to construct a commercial retail office and residential complex. The City Council then certified the final EIR for that project last September, making findings that the main residence is considered a significant historic resource and that the grain warehouse serves as a contributing factor to the setting of that main house. In response to this determination, the applicant has submitted a conceptual plan that retains all of the existing structures, thereby avoiding any potential significant impacts that were identified in the EIR. And it also should be noted that the EIR will be used for any environmental determination that's conducted on the project site. The revised project also includes a greater percentage of residential development in the overall mixed-use design, and that is encouraged in the land use and the housing elements of the general plan. So moving on, is smaller by approximately 1 acre. However, they do propose to have a shared access and some shared parking with that adjacent property owner. As with the circulation design for the previous project, there are two access points proposed on East Branch Street and then one on LaPointe Street. The project would also include a partial abandonment of LaPointe along the property frontage, as well as a controlled entry gate located between the residential and commercial components of the project to alleviate concerns that were discussed with the previous project about potential increased cut-through traffic from LaPointe over to East Branch Street. Okay, here we have residential plan A. This contains 8 units in 4 buildings. These duplexes are 3 levels with individual units ranging up to about 2,600 square feet in size. The units are stacked such that the upper 2-story residence is accessed from Crown Terrace and then the lower single story is accessed from ground level. Here we have residential plan B. This contains 16 units in 8 separate buildings. They're all 2 stories. The structures are much smaller in size. They are either from 420 square feet to 1,300 square feet in size. And now you can see the commercial office building, the elevations there. This structure is, again, 3 stories, similar to the residential plan A. It has an elevator and a 2-story parking garage, and access to the garage is from either Crown Terrace or from the interior of the project. The architectural style of the complex is Craftsman and California bungalow to fit in with the existing village flavor. Exterior materials for the commercial building could be modified to either keep it the way it is with the board and batten, or if you wanted to get back to the more historic era, you could remove the board and batten and have the exposed corrugated metal. So that's kind of a design option. Okay, with regard to development code requirements, the project is subject to the standards of the village mixed-use district, and then also to the parking requirements by land use. The overall project is short by about 7 parking spaces when you calculate the uses separately, although the parking would be in compliance when considering the mixed-use design and applying any type of shared parking analysis. The project also complies with density requirements with the setbacks of the district, lot coverage, height limits. Although the building size exceeds the maximum by 2,000 square feet, that's the only thing that is deviating from the development code standards. Inclusionary housing requirements per the 2003 housing element component and the innovative split level construction that takes advantage of the dramatic topography difference from Crown Terrace. to the last slide here. Since this is a pre-application, staff recommends that the City Council provide suggestions and comments to the applicant that will help facilitate processing of the formal project application when they return. I'd be happy to answer any questions. The applicant and the applicant's representative are here to answer any of the more detailed project-related questions.
Okay. Thank you. I do have just one clarification on the road abandonment issue. Does that mean that that section of La Pointe, which I believe serves three residences currently, would become a private road?
There are some different alternatives that are being looked at currently between the applicant and the Public Works Department. And I think I would defer that to Don Spagnolo for details regarding that. But I know that there's a water main that runs through there. There's some easements and whatnot that would need to be retained. The council may want to keep the option for the future to have a bridge across the creek, those kinds of things.
For all of those reasons, and maintenance notwithstanding, it would seem to be an issue that we would need to clarify, particularly with those three residents.
Right.
So, questions, clarifications for Kelly? Councilmember Dickens?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Kelly, I've got a couple questions. First is in regards to comparisons with the previous proposal. I noticed in that particular proposal that the EIR was considering, there was quite a bit of attention placed on what was referred to as the Tallyho Creek Park. I don't see any reference made to any kind of public access, pedestrian connections, parkway within the pre-application. Do you have any knowledge as to the applicant's desire to implement something similar to the previous proposal in regards to the Tallyho Creek Park and so forth?
The applicant doesn't have as much control over the property immediately adjacent to the creek. That property has been sold off. That's where the existing storage containers, those were to be removed and have a full creekway enhancement with the amphitheater and that kind of thing. There is opportunity to do some enhancement and open space adjacent to the creek where the residential is being proposed. So it's dramatically reduced, but they do have some opportunities to take advantage of what they do have.
But to date, there or at least what's before us this evening, there is no indication of any open space, park, pedestrian access on this particular proposal.
I believe that the applicant was fully intending.
The design before you this evening is a result of many years of analysis on this property. And as staff pointed out, primarily as a consequence of the finding of the potential historic resource through the EIR and the prior submittal, we have taken another look at the potential development of this site. There are other site constraints, and it's going to be difficult to point them out without having a pointer, but you may be able to see it in your package. There is a floodway setback from the creek that no structural development could occur. Star Wars. The floodway setback is no structural development can occur. However, the development of that would be available, and we're intending to develop it as an open space, active open space area for the residential development. These would be developed as a planned development. People would actually own their lot with the house footprint inside of that and then own in common all of the circulation, parking, and the active recreational area. We would envision that to be developed with creekside enhancement, play structures, picnic tables, maybe a barbecue or something of those nature.
If I can interject, would there be some form of a homeowners association?
Homeowners association would be the entity that would control the maintenance and ownership of that, and everyone would have a share in that, as well as all
CC&Rs and yes. the whole bit.
Correct. The other constraints, the steep embankment along Crown Terrace, it presents, I think, design solutions that are really exciting. And likewise, there is an easement through the middle of this where the driveway is shown. The easement is for sewer and gas line, and no structural development can occur there. So it pretty much forces us to locate driveways along through that easement area. As Steph pointed out, we have the potential historic resource as the other constraint and the retention of that. Now, we are proposing to do some remodel work on the existing Loomis barn. That is the area, the loading docks and the rear. This would enable correct and proper circulation to occur, and also additional parking. The historical original grain warehouse building itself would not be affected at all. It would simply be the loading docks that were added later years. The circulation for the project does create a separation between the residential area here and the commercial area here. We plan to have some form of control gate access so that the commercial users would not be able to enter the residential area. It would be a key gate or something of that nature. The residential users could certainly punch in their numbers. There would be no restrictions to access neighbors to the north after this site. In subsequent discussions with Public Works, there was some concern to retain that right-of-way for some future development, even though your future improvement through there and across Tally Ho Creek. Your general plan speaks very strongly about that with no encouragement. However, that to keep that option open, Public Works has decided, or just in our discussion with them, they'd like to see that right-of-way be available. However, at a 70-foot-wide right-of-way, there's a Lopez water line through there, and there's other easements through there and other utility improvements. So what we're discussing would be a partial abandonment that would retain access to the standard that Public Works would like to see, at least a 50-foot or more, and as long as there are buildings don't encroach into any of the utility easements, there might be some consideration for a partial abandonment there. That's not going to make or break this project. It only frees up the site a little bit so that the separation between units is more attractive. There's a greater setback distance and so forth. We could certainly redesign the units themselves and redesign the site plan, probably coming up with the same number without the road abandonment. But because it seems pointless to have such a wide right-of-way that's likely not going to ever happen, as long as it can be retained for future use, some partial abandonment would be considered. That's the story that we're getting from Public Works, and we're good with that. The commercial, the residential staff pointed out the designs take advantage of the site elevation changes. We would propose the four units that are abutting Crown Terrace, the access from Crown Terrace into the garage and then dropping down into the main body of the house. We'll probably end up doing airspace condominiums so that the lower unit itself would become an ownership unit. The two-story middle and third story of that would become an ownership unit. The other studios above the garage down in the flat area would be as a PD, that would not be segregated on each individual lot. Ideally, this would free up the opportunity to have an in-law house, a studio, an affordable unit, etc., and some mortgage relief if you have a studio that's a rental unit on each site. So I believe it widens the marketplace for home ownership as well. The the commercial building that's being proposed, we've tried to use the same style of design and architecture that you see on the adjacent structures, not knowing exactly what may happen with remodel of the barn and the two residences for future use if they convert to commercial, if they remodel to change their style and so forth, that could somewhat affect the commercial building that we're proposing, although the comments that we've received from ARC and Planning Commission both are comfortable with a board and batten style, and I think that would fit in with the village that we see at the easterly end of Branch Street. The circuit, and that would not, it would have a turnaround on the rear there, and it would not be unusual and or undesirable. It would still meet, satisfy city codes and standards. The statistics that are shown on site plan, essentially everything is driven by parking, and as staff pointed out, if you segregate these uses and identify what code is for residential versus commercial and so forth, we would come seven short. However, if you look at this as an entire development, we meet the standard. In fact, we meet all of the standards relative to development with the exception of the commercial office building. We propose a 12,000-foot building. There's a limitation in the development code of 10. We can certainly correct that by either developing two buildings there. We felt that because there is such a, well, there's a 25-foot grade separation between Crown Terrace and the floor of this site, theoretically, the 12,000 or 10,000-foot limitation was for a standalone building, so it would be not quite so austere to the eye. However, this plugs into that hillside with access from the east Crown Terrace onto the top floor of that parking garage, and likewise access from the base of the site into the parking garage without a ramp system, so you have a double access and stacked. But the overall appearance of the commercial building isn't as prominent as if we're standalone on a flat site. We'd like to hear comments from your council on that as well. Inclusionary housing, we would certainly satisfy the city's inclusionary housing standards. And access, as was one of the issues I noted that staff put up there, we have existing access. We'd be utilizing those and or creating a third access. If we find that's undesirable and not supported, we would simply retain the two accesses and have the parking area with the residential accessing off onto LaPointe. I hope I hit some of the high points of this redesign. We're excited about it, and hopefully we'll generate that same level of excitement through the community and have a project that can be supported and approved by the council and as time goes forward. With the completion of the pre-application, we intend to prepare all the additional plan material, all site elevations, color material board, grading, drainage, landscaping, and the long list of submittal requirements that the city requires. But appreciate your comments this evening.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens, I think we kind of cut in the center of some of your questions, so why don't you go ahead and finish?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Kelly, I was a little bit perplexed on one of the comments made in the staff report in regards to this particular redesign as being a greater mixed-use component or providing for a greater mixed-use component. So I ran some of the numbers in regards to the previous proposal as compared to the pre-application. So my comment, I guess, or to staff at this point is what is it? What is it? The desire is looking at mixed use, but where should we be placing our focus? Should our focus within the village core mixed-use area be in residential, or should we be looking at more of a commercial office And I think that would, that's, I'd like some feedback on that, because this, the project is flipped considerably towards residential.
Yeah, previously the it was 31,000 square feet of retail and 4,000 square feet, or retail and office, 4,000 square feet of residential. And that was with an extra acre that they do not have now. They are looking at either converting the warehouse to some other type of commercial use, or keep it as it is right now. So you put that into the equation. So that's 18,000. But it is definitely residential. With that three-level component, it allows to have greater square footage of the residential. As far as the general plan is concerned, I don't believe, and Rob, you can maybe come up here and help me out a little bit, but as far as the exact percentage mix, I think it's on a case-by-case basis. Here we have the master of the general plan.
As Kelly has indicated, there is no specific general plan policy related to what specific mixed use would be considered. It's a case-by-case basis. In this particular instance, obviously the property is at the edge of the village mixed-use district, not a part of the downtown village core district, which ends at Tally Ho. There certainly is some flexibility for interpretation. I believe the question was also raised at the Planning Commission whether a greater proportion of office could be accomplished if that were the preference of the city. And I think the interior tier of residential adjacent to the commercial parking area could, as an example, be treated more as a mixed-use concept or proposed as office. It's the prerogative of the property owner, obviously, to make the proposal and for the city to determine whether it meets the objectives of the city. This is a preliminary pre-application really designed to get your feedback. And if your concern is that there is an inadequate emphasis on commercial or office and an overemphasis on residential, that could certainly be taken into consideration in the final application.
I guess, Rob, my concern was in the staff report where it talks about this particular proposal being a greater, and the emphasis being on the word greater, mixed-use component. And I don't know whether they're both they were both mixed-use components. One just has a greater emphasis on residential as opposed to commercial and office. The future possibilities of a roadway extension on that particular area, I guess my question to staff would be, would it not be in the city's best interest to retain this easement for a future roadway extension?
I believe the Public Works Department would indeed like to retain a certain width to be able to allow for future expansion over the creek, or for just through traffic in that area. The adjacent right-of-ways are, I think it's 60 feet. The Public Works Director will put up an overhead here, and it's not. Well, they need to switch the. Where's Steve? I'll let you.
We need a technician here.
Well, maybe I can just describe what is the existing right-of-way to date. We have a 70-foot right-of-way that is from, and that's a little upside down, but we have a 70-foot right-of-way from 227 to what is now Tally Ho. So there's a 70-foot right-of-way that runs the entire length of LaPointe Street in that area. And as you pointed out, our preference would be to keep the right-of-way as it is because we don't know what it is going to be in the future, and it would be a lot more difficult to get it back than it would be to keep it. And we talked about some partial abandonment because I don't think the 70 feet is necessarily the width of the future road. somewhere. Our standard in this area would be 60 feet, so there may be a potential to relinquish 10 feet, but I think overall we want to keep the right-of-way.
Yeah, I guess my comments just at this point, I can do this towards the end, but my concern would be that whatever may or may not happen on that particular area for future road, it's going to be difficult to achieve that, first of all, due to a lot of other concerns. But with the addition of two new residents, which will be home ownership in those particular areas, will actually make it even that much more difficult, because I imagine that those folks would be very resistant in the future to having a through road and so forth. So I'm just looking into the future in regards to maintaining as much of that easement as possible, looking at the the future problems that may exist and trying to achieve a goal that may not happen today but could happen in the future. And Kelly, you kind of mentioned it, and we're not really sure, but you know, I had a comment here. What are the applicant's plans for the existing historic houses and the warehouse barn? And you talked about the possibility of converting those into some sort of commercial use. Do we have any more specific information in regards to those potential uses?
Well, the warehouse is an existing non-conforming structure. It's legal non-conforming. As long as the use remains the same, that can go on forever. It's when you change the use to something dramatically different that you need to look at building code requirements and those things. The residences...
It's up. I have one other question that I know the applicant will probably want to address as well, and I'll just bring it up to staff and then maybe some comments from the applicant. We've talked about the EIR, and we've gone through all of the issues in regards to this particular site, and a lot of the focus has been placed, of course, on the historic resources on this particular site, meaning the two existing houses, the warehouse barn. But the other issue that I've tried to maintain all along that I don't think is in the forefront is the Pacific Coast Railway right-of-way. That is considered a historic element to this particular property. And according to the EIR, the remaining segment of the rail bed appears eligible for listing in the California Register, which makes it a significant impact. There is mitigation set in place. So I guess my question is, with this particular proposal, what efforts have been made to preserve the existing rail bed, and what are going to be the appropriate mitigation measures placed on that?
There hasn't been substantial discussion during the pre-application, but it was pointed out at the Planning Commission level, and Mr. Bowd pointed out this evening that the alignment of the utility easement and the alignment of the driveway that's shown on this site plan coincides with the former Pacific Coast Railway alignment. Certainly a design feature could be some paving treatment or other design treatment that would show that as a previous historic location of the rail bed. There has not been a grading plan, a drainage plan, or a utility plan that would emphasize whether or not that would have to change for site improvement as proposed. But I believe that it could be accommodated and would be accommodated if it's discussed specifically in the EIR. The EIR would be the document that we would use to evaluate the project, its potential impacts and mitigation measure compliance. In addition to the development code.
Thank you, Rob. Mr. Mayor, those are all my comments at this point. If the applicant wants to respond, or that'd be fine.
As long as you're taking notes, why don't we just go ahead and finish, and then you can come up and address them all at once. Councilmember Reynolds.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just have a couple of comments to make on this. And number one, I think that this project is probably done more to enhance that area down there than anything that we've seen so far, and it's going to preserve those three buildings that everybody's been worried about for a long period of time. And as far as the old warehouse is concerned, there's going to be a multitude of problems with that, I would believe. But I think one of the things that Don brought out that we need to save the right-of-way that we have from Tallyho and LaPointe coming across so it connect to Tallyho because...
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think that the project that we're looking at, or the pre-application, comes a long way to solving the problems that we've seen with this property. It preserves the buildings that we want to see preserved, the historical integrity of them. There's some things I like about it, and there's things I'm not real thrilled about, but I'll discuss them both. I do think we want to preserve that right away and keep our options open on that. I have to agree with my colleagues. I like the concept of controlling the traffic flow and not letting people flow through onto LaPointe with a controlled gate. I think that's a fairly simple solution to what could be a thorny problem with flow-through traffic there. I like the multiple levels, using the hillside and access for the one level on that and the lower level. I don't see a particular problem with 12,000 square feet for that building at this point. I'd rather see one 12,000 square foot building than two other ones. And I don't necessarily think that I think that three stories fits well with the way the hillside is there. I like the concept of having the a little bit more residential availability there. However, I think that 420 square feet may be a little bit too small for some of those units. I don't know. It strikes me as possibly being a little bit too small. And I would not favor seeing a driveway between the house and the warehouse. I think that's something we'd want to avoid. That would probably detract from the setting that we've got. But I like what I see here, and I think that we're getting closer to something we can all live with.
Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I agree with pretty much everything that's been said. To recap, I think we need to keep the right-of-way. I'm not concerned if it goes down to 60 feet. If the houses are there and they're situated appropriately for that right-of-way, and certainly that the right-of-way is disclosed to these people so that they know that there is a right-of-way there for future, I have no problems with that. I kind of like the idea that we are increasing the residential, because one of the things that we've constantly talked about up here is infill and doing away with sprawl. Well, this is infill. This is right here in the middle of town, and I think it's an excellent idea to put the residential there. I don't really have a problem with the small units because they're defined as studios. And so somebody going into that is going to know it's a small unit. And anything that we can do to add to a perceived lower-cost unit would help in our city. By the time you get this bill, they'll probably be worth $1 million. But, you know, anything that we can do to increase our availability of small units, I'm in favor of. I like that idea. I like the idea of stacking the garage unit for the commercial so that you can come in on both sides. I think that's a real benefit. I don't have any problem with the parking being 7 under because of the shared parking capabilities. I see this in two ways. One is that it complements the historic buildings, but yet it stands alone. So even though we don't know today what will be the end result of the historic buildings, this project, I think, stands alone and can be presented very well by itself and complementing the historic buildings so that whole corner at the end of the village becomes a very blending situation with what we expect the village to continue to look like. I think there are still a little bit of things to be decided on the traffic patterns to the commercial area. I tend to agree. I don't think the driveway between the two buildings would be a good idea. So as long as it fits code, I have no problem with just blocking off that end if you can't create a shared access to the other property. As long as there's an entrance and an exit and it meets code, I don't have a problem with that. I really like the idea of the creekside improvements as part of this project and what can be done, especially the part that the Homeowners Association would be responsible for maintaining it and keeping it going, and that their CC&R is maintaining this whole process. One part that I didn't understand, which I'm sure would be discussed later, is with the association and with the CC&Rs, how does the commercial play into that, and would it have its own restrictions that would complement those CC&Rs, or would it be part of the CC&Rs? I'm not an expert in that, so I don't understand that, but I think that's a question that would probably need to be resolved, and so that the whole area stays the same and blends, continues to blend together. I like the idea that the commercial building is stacked into Crown Hill, and that some of the housing is stacked. I really believe that that's going to complement that area. And so overall, I'm very impressed. I think it's going to blend very well, and I think it solves a lot of the problems that we've been faced with over the last few years. And those are all my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. On the circulation issue, I too would favor, as was indicated by Public Works, perhaps a 60-foot right-of-way through there is sufficient. So I would support that. I think I'd like to see some additional working of the circulation aspect of this, so that we can maybe be kept informed, or at least continue to monitor alternatives so that we can ensure that there is good circulation through this traffic or through this development. As far as the and maintain sufficient right-of-way so that we can consider some alternatives, as far as the Pacific Railway, I would agree the rail bed perhaps needs to be acknowledged. Now, what does that mean? I think, Rob, you had a good idea, and as long as there's not a structure sitting directly on top of it, I think we can get along with perhaps a small section that depicts the location of the rail bed, and maybe we do it in different color pavers with a little pedestal sign and a little plaque that talks about the history of it. A very simple treatment that demarks the location and yet doesn't intrude a great deal on the project itself. I don't have an issue with the 12,000 square feet. I think the tiered approach and looking at the design of the larger commercial structure, I think Mr. Bout is correct that this can be treated in such a way that we're not confronted with a big, massive structure. It's it is based on its own design and the layout of the terrain, less intrusive, and perhaps would give the appearance of a smaller structure. I don't have an issue with that. As has been stated, we were, and we have been very adamant about, some of us have at least been very adamant about preserving the three structures. And I expected that a proposal such as this coming through, there would have to be some modifications in certain categories that would perhaps assist with the feasibility of moving forward with the project and yet meeting council's desire to preserve those structures. So there are trade-offs. And I believe one of the trade-offs is, in fact, perhaps the tendency towards residential as opposed to more commercial use that we saw proposed in previous projects. I don't have an issue with that for a couple of reasons. Number one, I agree with some of the comments that have been made that we need to continue to promote additional residential opportunities in the village core or close to the village core. When I say close to the village core, that in and of itself is a benefit because what a project such as this will do is encourage pedestrian use. This is a very pedestrian-friendly project that I see, regardless of the fact that it's tending towards more residential versus commercial. On the issue of commercial, I think the justification for some of my some of the comments that I just made was, in fact, that what is being proposed as commercial and perhaps retail, where are we here? Where's okay. Where's Branch?
I don't think it's on that map.
Okay, it's down here somewhere?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. What we're proposing, majority of it towards the back, is in fact residential. That being said, I need to discuss the potential viability, particularly of the feed warehouse, for that transitional use. And I understand that that particular structure needs a bit of work, and I'm not certain as to the intent of the applicant as far as the degree to which these all three of these structures would be rehabilitated. But it would seem to me that if we were going to hope to use and attract occupants to those three structures, I'm not saying that they have to be raised and rebuilt to the exact standards, but they certainly need to be rehabilitated to the extent that folks would be willing to move into them and set up some form of business. So aside from removing the loading docks, I would hope that there would be some plan in place to provide some form of rehabilitation for to encourage commercial occupancy of those structures. Thank you. I, too, would not like to see us take off or remove or change the surface treatment of this building to corrugated metal. I would much rather see a rehabilitated board and batten that better blends with, and I think you have more flexibility with board and batten from a design standpoint to blend with the rest of the project. It would be very difficult to blend corrugated metal with a larger project that you've outlined here. So that would be something that I would look to ensure as well. In closing, I think my only other, I guess, admonishment would not be to the applicant; it would be to us to be cognizant of the fact that this particular part of the of what was the original plan is no longer connected to it. It's under new ownership. Is that correct? So we have a different owner there. At a point in time in the future, if there is a plan submitted for this particular piece being adjacent, we would have to look towards some form of conformity in terms of design standards. And so in a manner similar as we have treated other cases in the community, we would want to be cognizant of that at some point in the future to make sure that we have consistency in architecture. And overall, as it relates to architecture, we want to make very, very certain that we don't wind up with something that we see at the other end of the village from a design standpoint. And I know that You've been through that once before with the other project, so you're very much aware of it. And so it's up to all of us to again be vigilant and make sure this thing progresses.
We'll come to a ground that works with Public Works and satisfies the comments you've made this evening. The through road, in my mind, you're going to have a whole lot of people on La Pointe Street that aren't going to be supportive of that, not just two residences on this site. So but that's just a personal observation. The comments on the rail bed, I think we can work with that. That shouldn't be a problem at all. I'm glad to hear you agree with my design thoughts on the 12,000-foot building. I believe that it won't be anything but compatible to the setting in which it's into that hillside, and it would not be obtrusive. The comments relative to the house and driveway having a the house and the warehouse with a drive-through there, I appreciate that. We'll either have a common driveway agreement with the off-site access point or not. That's something that's under negotiation. Whether it will be executed, I can't foresee the future on that one. But we do have a backup plan, and certainly we won't include a driveway between the house and the warehouse from hearing you this evening. The concept of a 420-foot studio unit is a studio above the garage. The house itself is 1,400-foot, two-story, two-bedroom. This would provide, I think, mortgage relief, and as I pointed out earlier, an in-law unit or a rental unit, whatever. I think more than anything, that opens up the marketplace for home ownership, knowing that there would be an opportunity. And it was pointed out at the ARC meeting, one of the members of whom is a real estate broker, he said that a unit like that in today's rental market would be $700 or $800, which is a big chunk if you factor that into a mortgage on a residence. And I think that would provide a great housing opportunity for a lot more folks. Yes, the creekside improvements would be controlled and maintained by the Homeowners Association. As to the limit and the extent of the commercial, we haven't defined that. Most likely there would not be a relationship. The commercial, which would simply be a commercial owners association for parking and driveway purposes, lighting and so forth, but not accessing the parkland active recreational area for the residential area component of the project. And I'm going to let the property owners discuss what's planned for the existing structures. Frankly, I don't know, and I don't know if they know, but they might be able to shed some light on that. Thank you again for your comments this evening.
Thank you.
Good evening, Dwayne DeBlau. I just want to say thank you for your comments, and we appreciate them, and we'd just like to try to get ourselves to adapt to what the current council's direction would love to enhance that and use it as it currently is, which is existing non-conforming use. And they have some great ideas, and at this stage, that's about all we can say as far as the use of the property is concerned. But they are definitely people that we feel have the interest of the property and the city at heart as far as adaptively using those buildings. So, and if you have any questions, I think that's all I had to say. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Kelly, anything else?
No, that's it.
Okay. Does that give you give everyone sufficient direction, feedback? Okay. All right, that takes us to item number 12, City Council Member Items. There are none this evening. City Manager Items, indicating none, Steve?
No, sir.
Any council communications, correspondence, comments?
Mr. Mayor, I just had one, if I could, as a request for staff to give the council an update on the track 17, the county track 1798. I know that's, I believe that is in the process of a draft EIR, and I am not sure whether we as a city are responding to that EIR, but I'd like to have the council updated on that particular proposal and any environmental concerns that staff sees.
So. Is this the one that affects Leticia in that area? Or is this something different?
No, it'd be the back. No, this is back behind the high school. Adjacent to the city, between
Vista Del Mar,
between Vista Del Mar.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mayor, members of the council, I did distribute about a week ago a draft letter which was discussed at the Planning Commission level. This is the Busick track, which proposes 16 lots in the vicinity of Vista Del Mar, accessible off of a extension of a road called Coast View Road out of Falcon Ridge. The commission did suggest a few changes to the letter, but basically we identify several concerns with the draft EIR, water resources, air quality. The principal focus was traffic and alternatives to traffic, including the safety of the El Campo interchange, which would be affected by the additional trips. That letter is being transmitted either today or tomorrow because the deadline for comment is the 15th of March. If you have any...
You also mentioned the, in passing, Steve, the Leticia Ag Cluster. And Rob, I want to thank you for responding that and providing that information as well. I know there are many concerns about the traffic impact coming out of the winery onto 101. Certainly adds to the to an already hazardous condition, and so I appreciate you the comprehensive response you gave to that one. Anything else for city? Council communication. Okay, staff communication.
Just one real quickly, a couple of announcements primarily for the public's benefit. Wanted to take another opportunity to just announce a couple important meetings coming up this month. Probably bring it up one more time at the next meeting. Thursday, March 25th is our next public workshop regarding the City Hall complex needs assessment and feasibility study. And at the prior council meeting, the council narrowed down the alternatives to three preferred alternatives that now are being further studied, and conceptual drawings are being drafted, which will be presented at that workshop. And we'd like to get additional input, so that's important. We'd like to get as many people from the community to attend that as possible. And then March 30th, also at 6:30, but this meeting would be at the Women's Club, Rio Grande Community Center, and that meeting is a public workshop to get as much input we can from the community regarding potential future land uses in the at the Fredericks and Williams properties currently within the city's sphere of influence. And it's just kind of a preliminary step in starting to look at what the community and the property owners would like to see there in the future, and we want to start by getting people's ideas and input. And that's the purpose of that meeting.
And the times are?
6:30 at the community center on March 30th for the Sphere of Influence workshop. And once again, the City Hall workshop's March 25th, which is a Thursday, also at 6:30, but here in the council chambers.
Do we have a morning meeting as well on the Sphere of Influence? I thought we had
not at the first meeting. We've okay. scheduled a second later in April, where we're going to probably have two in
okay.
one day.
Good. Yeah. Anything else?
No, necessarily there at all.
That takes us to item 16, community comments and suggestions, opportunity for anyone to come forward and make a comment, observation on any item, regardless of whether it's on the agenda.
Mayor, Council, Steve Ross, 211 Garden Street. I attended the commission meeting regarding the tract by Vista Del Mar. They felt that part of their mitigation would be to close northbound access off of El Campo. My concern about that is that people are still going to need to make northbound access. I know that a lot of people use El Campo that are coming from farther inland. I don't know that they're coming all the way from Cypress Ridge, but I know as El Campo goes up towards Cypress, doesn't need any more traffic either. I think that while blocking off El Campo might be a good thing as far as safety is concerned, it certainly doesn't do any favors to the other infrastructure and areas that would be affected by traffic that would takes that road now and additional traffic from a new subdivision. That would be mostly my comment.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, seeing none, we'll close our final community comments and suggestions. That takes us to item number 17, motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Okay, thank you very much. We are adjourned.